Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building at 67 East 11th Street in Greenwich Village, City of New York. Thank you very much for coming out. This is our final event of 2011. We've had some amazing events this year, and we're going to start this one like we always do. To those of you who are in the clubhouse for the first time, welcome. To those of you who have been here before, welcome home. In 51 years of living, occasionally you have to throw a little BS out there. It just happens. But when you come across someone whom you truly respect, you can't throw any BS out there. And Nick is one of those people whom I truly respect. And I've been fortunate enough to meet Nick through this clubhouse that opened last summer. And Nick said, oh, would you like to have George Vesey come for an event? And I thought he was kidding, frankly. And in all honesty, other than saying, would you like to have Sandy Koufax come, there are very few other people who I would have had this reaction to. And it is really an honor to welcome George Vesey to the clubhouse. I've devoured everything he's written since I'm a kid. I don't want to make you feel older or anything.
I'm old.
And it is truly a pleasure. And I think what we're going to do tonight is we're going to have George speak for a bit, and then we'll have plenty of time for question and answer, so don't worry about that. But since this night was brought to us originally through Nick, who's with Metro Baseball Magazine, I'd like to turn it over to Nick at this time and let him take over the show.
Thank you, Jay. Obviously, I share with you the feelings about George. My name is Nick D'Arienzo. I'm the executive editor of a new quarterly magazine called Metro Baseball Magazine. We're very local. We give it away free to little leagues and high schools throughout the metro area. But what we're trying to do with all the negativity, et cetera, in the game of baseball, trying to celebrate the very good that made us fall in love with the game in the first place. So it's something that's available at Bergino. Our next issue is coming out in a week, and we hope you'll check it out. Since tonight our subject is Stan Musial, words like class, integrity, humility, one of the best there's ever been come to mind. But as Jay and I both feel, those words could also be used to characterize our guest of honor, George Vesey. So let's please give him a hearty welcome to the clubhouse.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, and I really appreciate y'all turning off the TV behind there, because just before there was I don't know if you saw it, there was a live or film shot of Pujols having his first press conference in Los Angeles or Orange County, being greeted by Mr. Moreno. And with your Angels cap on, I'm sure for those Cardinal fans who's only a month away or something from looking at them winning the World Series, to see him in another uniform, it must be galling. As a sports writer, I don't have such strong feelings about desertion, because I've seen it both ways. I mean, I see enough players who are deserted by the ball clubs for reasons of money, and they make decisions and say, well, you're not worth what we were paying you or what you're asking. I learned from my friend Al Campanis, a wonderful man who was letting Steve Garvey go at the end of the season, and I asked him how he could do it, and he said, well, we love Garv, we'd like to have him back, we just don't want to have him back at what the Padres can pay him. But I learned from Al about that it wasn't that they didn't have a room for him the next year, but that they didn't have room for him, and I think St. Louis was the same way. The one thing that Pujols leaving, at his age and for the money that he's getting, it's a great deal for him, I suppose. It does point out the difference between some of the iconic players. And there are, the DiMaggio and Williams and Musial, all in the same era. What bound them together, not only as being great players, but in an era of no free agency, that they pretty much had to stay. In some cases, there were trades that were planned, or that in Musial's case, he actually, as I point out in the book, that he was traded once, that the trade was pretty much in the works, but Musial had his business partner go to Gussie Bush and say, Stanley's not going, he'll retire first. And that was the power that he had. He didn't want to be traded, but he could have been. So having lived through, and I was a kid in the days when my favorite team, when I was a kid, the Brooklyn Dodgers, why did they stay together so long? I mean, Duke Snyder was always saying, Brooklyn doesn't deserve a great guy like me. Well, he couldn't go anywhere. So as a result, he had all of his career finishing up in a few other places, but essentially he was a Dodger, and that was because those were the bad old days. So it gave you the continuity. Musial is indeed one of a kind, because not only did he play all his career in St. Louis, but he loved the city so much. And when I was given a chance to write about him, and I've known him since I was 7 years old, I can remember the 19, just to prove how old I am, I can remember the 1946 World Series. And we were talking about, you know, great six games and great World Series we've seen. And I just remember that one. I don't remember listening to the seventh game, but I've always felt that the 1946 World Series, it's so epic to me, because it was the first one I remember being on, you know, at least the radio. And my father would bring home the glossy pictures from the Associated Press, and I had all the pictures of the two teams in my house. Be a great collector's item these days if you could. And of course, my mom, I'm sure, threw them like all moms, I'm sure she threw them out. But I remember Musial and Williams. I mean, these two great players going against each other in the World Series, and knowing that this was going on, what made them so great, even though they were relatively early in their career, that they were identified with those two teams, and they never would play for any other team. So to get a chance to write about somebody who was one of my favorite players, I mean, I love Musial, he came into Brooklyn, and if I can speak a little bit of Brooklynese to y'all, he would come in and he used to moiter us. And he did. And I got to talk to some of the old Dodgers who were still around, Ralph Branca and Don Newcomb. And Nuke was great about it. I've known him for a long time. Just a wonderful man. I called him out in California and I said, Nuke, what about Musial? And he said, wore my ass out. but then over the phone, there's this pause and he said, ask him who won the games. And Nuke's point, of course, you put it that way, but Musial knew it also, was that the Dodgers had their own deck stacked the right way by going after African-American players early. The Cardinals were one of the last teams to do it, and they suffered. And Musial knew that. But Musial was the icon of those days. I mean, even when Jackie Robinson and Hodges and Snyder came along, we still in Brooklyn. And those were the good old days, because you actually could cheer a visiting ball player. You could understand the greatness of him. Nowadays, it's the S word that got popular in the Steinbrenner Red Sox era of the late 70s. All of a sudden, everybody uses it in the ballpark. It's a different time and place. People would yell things at visiting players at Ebbets Field, to be sure. But Musial was one of a kind. So the chance to write about him was a real trip for me. I had never really had a conversation with him when he was playing. I did cover some of his games. I was in his restaurant. I was in groups around him. But I never actually got to interview him. So when I was writing a history book, baseball history book, about 5 years ago, and it was the first sports book in a history by Modern Library, and in the course of writing this book, I did a little riff, as writers will. I started doing a riff on Stan Musial as being the epitome, the 6 degrees of separation of baseball. It came from nowhere except somewhere in my heart or my head that Musial had touched so many bases on that. On backwards to Branch Rickey and George Sisler in St. Louis, and then going forward. I mean, he played against guys that were still playing into the 70s that were his colleagues when he was finishing up in the early 60s. So I made this riff. Somebody saw in this history book, an editor saw it, and they came to me and they said, would you like to do a book on Stan Musial? You know, a labor of love, but of course they paid me for it. It was certainly worth doing. One of the things is, as a writer, and I'm sure you all have your opinions on Musial, where he fits in as a player, and I would go over some of that. In a broader sense, one of the things I wanted to do about Stan Musial was to write about it as a person. Was he really as good a person as people remember? Did he deserve the kind of adulation that he gets in St. Louis and in Brooklyn? And that leads to one of the great writer fears. And I can say this now. This is not a talk, you know, when I was at Foley's in the summer is not something that I would have said back then. But you with a little bit passage of time from the time the book came out, you start to think to yourself, what if I'm wrong? What if I got this wrong? As you're working on the book, what if I missed something? So there's a certain paranoid feeling you have of writing somebody because a lot of music was not available. He was not going to be available to me. He has Alzheimer's. His family was not going to make him available, even though he does go out socially. His wife, who's still pretty sharp, and she's his age or a little bit older, she was not going to be available either. Fortunately, I had a very good friend, a television producer and a man about town named Willie Weinstein, who lives in the area. His dad is here in the back. Willie introduced me to a guy who introduced me to a guy who introduced me to Stan Musial's daughter. And as a result, because she's the iconoclast, she lives in San Francisco.
One correction, Weinbaum.
I'm sorry, Ms. Weinbaum.
Right. Close.
That because Jerry lives in San Francisco and her ex lives in New York, I had access to him in New York, and then I was doing on the phone with him. I did have access into the family, and it was such a great thing to be able to hear a woman not much younger than me, really, tell what it was like to grow up, what kind of a father Stan Musial was, but even in a broader sense, the way they lived. And we're so used to the ostentatious way that athletes live today, you know, these McMansions they have with their gyms and their basketball courts and their, you know, their great halls and all that. She grew up, her dad was one of the great players in baseball, and they lived in a very ordinary neighborhood in St. Louis, where, you know, walk to church, little kids would come by on bicycles and wait to see. I got in that neighborhood for the first time this fall during the World Series, and I took a look, and I was even surprised in driving through it, and somebody showed me the street that they lived on, just how an ordinary middle American it was. But she said it was a great time to be there because people were respectful, people didn't form big lines out in front of the house. He could live in the neighborhood and he could go out there and be himself. A mailman would come by, talk to him. Stanley, in this time of year, would be up on the roof of his house hanging up Christmas lights. In fact, she said one year that my father won the third prize in the St. Louis Hills Civic Association for best Christmas decoration. Now, I don't know. I don't know if Pujols is up there on the roof himself, if indeed he's still going out in St. Louis. But those are the kind of personal things that I wanted to get. I don't consider myself a stat guy. I'm not necessarily the greatest researcher, reporter in baseball, or in anything. My life is mostly about writing, getting the sense of people. Where I was lucky in that a lot of the old ball players, I do know them, the generosity of one leading to the other, that I could pick up a phone and broker a call with Don Newcombe, who he cussed me out during the 1949 All-Star game, although he denies that. I asked him for his autograph after he got whacked around by the American League, and he said, get that so-and-so out of here. I would never do that, he said. Well, I think a kid remembers that. But he's a wonderful guy. And, to call him up and be able to get a sense of what it was like to pitch to Musial and to ask a guy who was living in those times and who knew me. I mean, Newcomb's the kind of guy, when Al Campanis got himself in trouble, I could call Nuke and say, Nuke, tell me about Campanis. And Nuke would say, a wonderful man. I don't know what he was talking about. He didn't deserve the trouble. So I have this relationship with him. To be able to call him out in Los Angeles and hear him talk about pitching to Musial, and I said, what about the stance? What about the Musial stance? And Newcombe said, don't let that fool you. Said, yes, he did go all the way back, and he got his weight back, and he looked over his shoulder and all that. He said, by the time I'm releasing the ball, he's unlocked his hips. He's going after the ball. There were only 70 pitchers at any time in the National League in those days. And Newcombe said that Musial knew every pitcher in the league. He saw them enough. He studied them, not so much in videos and the tools that they have today. But Nuke said that this guy knew what you were doing. He knew what you were throwing. And by the time you were at your release point, he was already coming out of his stance. And in his great gymnast, Musial was a gymnast when he was a kid in the Polish halls in Genora, Pennsylvania. And then I got to talk to Robin Roberts before he passed, talking about Musial and how Musial hit so many home runs off him. And some of the other guys, Branca, and and Ralph Kiner. Now, Ralph Kiner would talk about, and I've known him as long as he's in New York, and Ralph would talk, he's such a great, you know him from Kiner's Corner and all that, but to be able to call him in the off season or wherever it was, and for him to tell me about what it was like to be a, you know, fellow star, not that he's blowing his horn, but they had the same kinds of careers, and to go into a restaurant, the Pirates would be in town playing the Giants up at the Polo Grounds, and the Cardinals, man, what a wonderful time for baseball in New York. The Cardinals would be in New York, and they'd be playing out in Brooklyn, and many of the teams did stay in Brooklyn. They'd stay at one of the hotels down there, but Kiner said that you'd go into a restaurant, and it's in the book, and I'm blanking, Bertolini's, it's still down in the Village, I gather, and Kiner said, I'd be sitting at a table with a couple of my guys, and Stan and Red would come in, and they'd be at another table, and he said, you weren't really supposed to fraternize. In a lot of ways, we didn't. It was a different time, but that with Musial was different, because everybody liked Musial. Nobody had a grudge against him. Nobody would avoid him or not talk to him, so you'd send a bottle of wine back and forth or whatever you would do. But to hear this from guys who were still around, I was blessed in that. Those were the contacts that I was able to call in. And you found out that people were still alive, that Denny Littweller, I had no idea. He was Musial's first friend. When Musial broke into baseball, there was a little group of sort of milk drinkers or clean livers, let's say, if not milk drinkers, but clean livers. Denny Littweller was one. He was the only college graduate on the Cardinals when Musial broke in. So they had a little group called the College Boys. Now, Musial, you know, barely got out of high school, but they were called the College Boys because it was a sort of a, you know, for Walker Cooper and Mort Cooper and some of those tough guys, it was not exactly a term of compliment. It meant these guys were going home to their wives in the evening or, you know, whatever it meant. But Littweiler was still alive. I had no idea. And I got him at home. He was prepared. I'd read his book. And I just wanted him to tell me a couple of the best stories that were in his book. I just wanted to make sure. And he didn't have a whole lot of extra memory. I wasn't able to drag things out of him. But he certainly was able to confirm some of the things in a book that he had written with somebody else. And he's right. He's since passed, as has Robin Roberts. I mean, that's the sad thing about talking to octogenarians. But there was one day when I was making phone calls that I talked to two nonagenarians, Littweiler, and a guy named Freddie Schmidt, who was in the 1944 and 1946 Cardinals, told me a great story about, and Freddie was like, why don't you come down? He found out that I have a daughter who lives in Pennsylvania. He said, come on down. I'm not far off the turnpike, and come on up. We'll have some beers at local VFW hall. You know, but I never did. But in the course of it, he told me the story about in the 46 World Series that when Ted Williams came up for the first time in the World Series, that the Cardinal players all raised imaginary shotguns in the air and said, Ted, they're up there. I guess Williams had gotten in trouble during the 46 season for shooting pigeons in the morning at Fenway Park. You know, what else do you have to do in Boston at 8 o'clock in the morning? He'd go up and shoot pigeons until somebody heard about it, and he had to stop doing it. So now the Cardinals, according to Schmidt, are shooting imaginary pigeons. And Williams, you can imagine what he was telling them what to do. But so what do I do? My nonagenarian is telling me the story. I call up one of my octogenarians, Joe Garagiola, whom I've known for a long time. I said, Joe, did that happen? And Joe was the catcher in that game. And Joe said, I don't remember. He said, I was so scared. Williams came up to bat, and you know, he said something, and I said, yes, sir, yes, sir. He said, I wasn't about to make any remarks to him or do anything foolish. So Joe didn't remember, but I used the anecdote anyway. I think I said this is Schmidt's story, and he however I phrased it. But it was I got such a kick out of hearing the story. And the other guy I talked to, the other octogenarian, was Sally Hemus, who benched Musial and was not too popular with some of the African-American players ever since the time that he confused Julio Gotay with Bob Gibson. He was calling Gibson Julio for a while, which Gibson does tend to remember. But I had heard that Hemus felt that the Musial family was still harboring a grudge because he benched Stan in 61 or whenever that was, 60 or 61. And Jerry Musial said, you know, please tell Mr. Hemus that, you know, I remember his wife and his little daughter and we were friends and we have no bad feelings. So I called Hemus and I was able to tell him that. But he had other versions of why he benched Musial. He said the guy wasn't hitting well, and he was 40 years old or wherever he was, and it was time to bench him. So unreconstructed manager at the age of 85 or whatever Solomon is. But those are the kinds of things, the cards that I was able to call in. So I was pretty much getting the feeling that the Musial that I thought I knew was the person that I was going to be able to write about, that there was no deep, dark secrets. And then somebody told me, I can't remember where I heard this, but somebody told me about the 1960 campaign for John F. Kennedy. One of the themes of the book, if any of you have had a chance to read it, is what a wonderful life that Musial has had. He's a pretty ordinary guy. You know, education is one thing, but after he finished playing, he kept growing. He kept meeting people. He had a Polish-American rich guy, a friend of his from Philadelphia, and James Michener was a drinking buddy of his, and the three of them would go off to Poland and meet this young archbishop from Poland named Wojtyla, which did them very well a few years later when the guy was living in Rome. Musial had an active life. He got to know things. He went places and did things. And in 1960, while he was still a player, he had done some campaigning for John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy had very wisely, recognizing that he was a heartland, Roman Catholic, popular guy, maybe, and a Democrat, registered. Musial had very active in the union movement and all that. So John F. Kennedy had looked up Musial and said, hey, when the season's over, would you go out and campaign for me? So there was this great plane, Jerry Hofberger, of the who owned the Baltimore Orioles, from National Brewing, he had a plane that he made available. And Jeff Chandler was on this, and Wizard White, who was a judge or a lawyer at that time before he went on the Supreme Court, and a number of other people. A couple of the Kennedy wives were on the trip from time to time. But for a week, while Musial was out on the road, one of the people on the road with him was Angie Dickinson. All right, now I remember Angie Dickinson. I was in the ballpark with the Yankees in Dodger Stadium in 1962, before the Big A was built. And Angie Dickinson was waiting she had a date after the game. And now John F. Kennedy was still alive, and Frank Sinatra was still around. And both of them, she's been connected to them. But that night she was meeting Bo Belinsky, came out of the game and pitched a very good game against the Yankees. And she's standing right there, one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. I was 23, and this was a movie star. So now, of course, I'm saying, Stan was on the road. What must that have liked? As it happens, Angie Dickinson is very much alive. She lives out in Malibu. She's more than willing to talk on the phone. Somebody told me that Lil Musial was not too thrilled with Musial being on the road with, you know, for a week with this movie star. But I mean, there were a lot of other people around. There were other, you know, other women and stuff. But I called her. She told me the most wonderful stories of being on the road, what a nice guy he was, and how the remarks he would make, she'd say, they were all like hardcore Democrats, obviously campaigning for JFK, and they'd go up to some place in what we now call the red states, and they'd be out in North Dakota somewhere, or Nebraska, and they'd get up, and people wouldn't even talk to them. They'd go to some country club to give a speech, and people, the ladies playing bridge with the blue hair would just go, ooh, you know, here come some Democrats. And she said it was really pretty nasty, even when they were making speeches, but their ace in the hole was Stanley the Democrat. They'd put him out there, and he'd say, you know, hey, I'm Stan Musial, I'm from the Cardinals, you hear our games on KMOX, and people would cheer. Like, Jeff Chandler couldn't believe that these people could turn 180 and cheer for Musial. Of course, they all love Musial, but she told me such wonderful stories. Well, she was so nice about him, naturally your imagination gets going. But then she added these stories about Lil Musial and the parties that they've been to since and what a good friend she is. So even at that, like thinking, oh my goodness, what happens now if she, in addition to telling stories of the president and Frank, if she tells me, but you know, there were no stories. I don't know what I would have done with that. You know, I just don't know, because intrepid reporter that I am, it would sort of blow the whole, you know, good family man image out of the water. But I'm here to report to you that in years that followed, that Lil Musial would go to Gene Autry's house out in the Palm Springs somewhere, and they'd all be around the piano, and Angie and Dilbo. So anyway, no story. It went on that way of me of me getting pretty well the idea. And I wrote it. The book came out this spring. It was a bestseller. Before it came out, Musil was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and I was able to get to the White House. I could tell you in short form or long form about being in the White House and seeing Stan Musial. By now, I don't know if he knew where he was. I mean, I couldn't tell. I saw him once in a restaurant last year. I got to shake his hand. I was introduced to him. And I'm standing outside the White House at the security. Somebody scored me a pass to be with the family. Wasn't a family person, but somebody I know in politics got me a to be in the audience up close, as close as y'all are to where the president was with all these people getting the award. And there's Musial being wheeled in by his handsome young grandson. And it was a cold day, beautiful day. Along comes this very handsome woman. Musial is looking at a picture somebody has given him of the time that he visited John F. Kennedy in the White House in 1962. That's in the book. And this very handsome woman, you know, some in her 80s, very erect and full of energy and well-dressed, she comes up and she looks at the picture and she says, "Oh, that's my brother." Well, it was Gene Kennedy Smith. And I you know, Musial didn't react. You know, he didn't like, you know, any of us. I mean, we were like, me and the lawyer guy who had shown the picture, this is just quite a scene to see Mrs. Smith talking to him, but Stan didn't react to it. But to be in the White House, now, ask me later, I'll tell you the story about Obama walking by and shaking a few hands, and I don't think I've washed my hands, because it was instinctive grace of him reaching out as he had to go to a meeting. But to see him sitting around hacking around with Yo-Yo Ma, his buddy, and then just out of grace seeing a couple of us standing there and gawking and saying hello and shaking hands, one of the fringe benefits of having worked on the book. All of that happened. The book came out. It was a bestseller, and in the New York Times list particularly, got pretty good reviews. A few people judge him by the standards of the guy in the New York Times wrote about it, very good, has great credentials. Was judging Musial by the standards of, why didn't he do more to get black players into baseball? Why didn't he do more for Jackie Robinson? And it's yuppie standards of 2011 being applied to a man who in 1947 told his Southern teammates, "I'm in, I'm playing, we're going to Brooklyn, I'm going out on the field," and that pretty much ruined the whole idea. If that isn't a bit of, you know, you could call it courage, you could call it just doing your job, you could call it just being a mensch, stand the mensch. Any way you look at it, Musial was a man for his time who, because he played with black guys in high school, one of them named Buddy Griffey, father of Ken, grandfather of Junior, was a teammate, a high school teammate of Musial in Denora, Pennsylvania. All three Griffies are from Junior, was born in Denora. Bertie went back to make sure that she had the baby, Junior, in Denora. And this was Musial. You know, I played with those guys. I got no problem with it. And when it came up, when the Southerners on the St. Louis Cardinals in 1947 were talking about it, his point was, I knew a guy named Buddy Griffey and a guy named Grant Gray. He didn't talk about this in public. You can't find a quote in the papers of those days about Musial saying why he was playing or anything about the boycott. He never went public on it. But his position to his friends was, in high school, they got to a tournament in Pittsburgh, and they were in a restaurant, and the restaurant put up a screen between them and the other patrons. It wasn't for their security. It was because there were two black guys out of 10 on the basketball team. The guys got up. All 10 of them got up and walked out. Their coach was a Notre Dame guy who had actually played a little bit of football or been a student of Newt Rockne, was so proud of them. And that was the legacy that Musial had. That was the way things were done in his group and his life and his world, even in Denora, which was not perfect by any means. There's a lot of America stuff. The subtitle of the book is An American Life, and I'm very proud of that because Appalachia is... you know, it's my part of the world, and I lived there, I covered there, and to go into Denora and feel very much at home with the way I liked it in West Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee, I was very much at home there. Wasn't perfect, but I have a lot of stuff in there about the place and the way Stan Musial grew up. By the time the book came out, I was convinced that Musial was the person that I wrote about. He was the person I wrote about was the person we think he was. Two stories before you have. Are we close to having
good.
Two stories? After the book came out, my phone rang. I was out on the desk, and it was Joe Garagiola, whom I've known for a long time. And Joe has had some health issues. I've written about him. He had some brain surgery a few years ago, and the doctor got it. The doctor took care of it. He's back, and he's okay. Joe calls me, and he's a very emotional man. He's a wonderful man. He called me. He's close to tears. He says, George, I got to tell you, you know there's a feud between Garagiola and Musial. The feud came up. It's in the book. I'll shorthand it by saying a business deal that went bad. They haven't talked to each other in 20 years. Now the phone rings. It's Garagiola. And he said, George, I want to thank you for the way you handled that. You were fair to me. You were fair to Stan. You know, he deserves the book. You didn't make him out to be perfect in that sense. You told my side of it, and you respected my off-the-record stuff. You didn't blow me out on it. And he was like, I won't say he was crying, but he was very emotional on the phone. When a friend of yours, when somebody you write about feels that you haven't, you know, whacked them, that you've gotten the situation, the saddest thing in Graziola's life probably is that this friendship went bad and that I was able to handle it in a way that he could live with and that people would know about. Anyway, I got that call. The other part of it was, never having been able to interview Stan Musial, I wondered. I met him in a restaurant. I met him again. I did shake his hand at the White House afterward. His daughters introduced me to him. But I wondered what he thought about the book and what people were telling him about the book. His business manager was pretty nice about it, without having given me a whole lot of help. But nevertheless, the business manager liked the book. A couple of weeks ago, a month or two ago, I got this letter, and it's from Tom Ashley, the son-in-law, former son-in-law of Stan Musial, who lives in New York. And Tom is the guy that Willie Weinbaum put me in touch with, and Tom has been a great help to me. And it's very nicely handwritten, you know, beautiful stationery, the old school. It's not an email. It's not a Twitter, whatever that is. And it says, Dear George, word has drifted back to me that the Musial family loved your work. Stan no longer signs to, in other words, he won't put your name on something any longer. You know why. However, my daughter got him to sign one for you and another for me. I thought you'd appreciate this copy for the beautiful job you did on Stan's life. It was a thrill to be a small part of it. Hope to see you soon with my best regards, Tom. An act of grace on Tom Ashley's part. The book came. It had Stan's signature, recognizable. I don't think it was Pat, his longtime secretary, who sometimes has been, you know, people say that. But Camille, the granddaughter, was there when Stan signed it. So I'm taking it to the bank that this Sharpie autographed book, which I would have brought in, but it's now in plastic cover in my house. It's an act of grace from them. It confirmed. I came down and showed it to my wife, and my wife, she's more tired than I am. Whenever I work on a book, she's like, "Get it over with, get it done. I'm tired of hearing about Stan Musial. Let's move on." So when I brought this down and showed it to her, there were tears in her eyes too. That the entire effort turned into something where a granddaughter could go to and say, "Granddad, would you write the sign one for my dad, for Tom in New York, and sign this one for the guy?" And he did. It's the ultimate act of grace. I think I got it right. He is as good a person, and the people around him are as good as I wrote about it. And that's the person that I presented to you. I hope for those of you who get a chance to read the book, who have already, I'd be glad to talk about it. I know we're going to change the camera, and I'll be available. I appreciate you being here and for caring about the same things I care about. Thank you very much.
That concludes part one.